Good morning and welcome everyone again to Spirit Mornings on the Spirit Catholic Radio Network. Bruce McGregor along with
Chris McGregor.
And always a treat to have him back with us. Joseph Pierce joining us again this morning. Joseph, the author of numerous acclaimed biographies of major Catholic literary figures. Writer in residence at Ave Maria University in Florida and editor of the Ignatius Critical Edition series, which is a collection of classic literature accompanied by literary analyses from a variety of notable scholars. Joseph has been talking with us about many of the wonderful books that he has. Today we have in the spotlight, though, his new one, Through Shakespeare's Eyes, Seeing the Catholic Presence in the Plays.
It's been a long time.
It's been too long, but then again, you've been a very busy, popular guy out there, so congratulations.
Partly thanks to you.
Oh, go on. Thanks to Shakespeare.
You've been very, very supportive of me over the years, and I very much appreciate it. I don't know. I've never actually met either of you folks, but I suspect you're great fun, too. I always have a great deal of fun just in the interviews with you, because you know what you're talking about, and you like what I'm doing, and that's great. So many interviewers just read from the list of questions that the publisher sends them, you know, and you might be planning to do that after that.
No, they're gone. Rip them up.
I know in the past, from my memory, that you'd actually made a point of actually reading my books, which unlike most people. Yeah.
Joseph, I'm hoping that this is just one in a whole series of books that we'll be taking a look at William Shakespeare and getting to know him through the plays.
You're wonderful. I'm actually, as we speak, in the middle of writing several chapters on Romeo and Juliet. I've also written several chapters on Macbeth, and I already have plans for another book. You can't keep me away from Shakespeare.
Oh, those are my favorites, too. I can't wait. Well, it's just been so exciting. Ever since you wrote The Quest for Shakespeare, I mean, how this has blossomed, and just an enthusiasm on the part of anybody who loves Shakespeare to have yet another opportunity to go back and visit through these eyes. Oh, the plays just come alive, Joseph.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the experience that I had, is that once I realized that Shakespeare was a Catholic through the huge amount of documentary evidence from his life that I assembled in my previous book, The Quest for Shakespeare, you know, it became clear to me that we can now reread the plays through those eyes, through the eyes of the Catholic Shakespeare, and just see the plays come to life, blossom, as you put it. And, you know, it's been a great discovery for me to go back and reread all the plays since my discovery of Shakespeare's Catholicism. And it does just bring multifarious new and deeper meanings that, you know, inform us not only about Shakespeare and his work, but about our own Catholic faith.
Well, I just have to say, before we get into even further discussion, one of the great blurbs that I have on the back of your jacket, Through Shakespeare's Eyes, was from Peter Kreeft. And he says that Joseph Pierce writes piercingly brilliant books.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that, I mean, that's what I found particularly in this book, Through Shakespeare's Eyes, because Joseph, anybody who thinks that they can't sit through Shakespeare, or they don't understand, like, The Merchant of Venice or Hamlet, I mean, pick up this book, and then you'll want to race out and either get one of the best movies of the versions that are out there, or just read the plays.
Yes, I actually would, although obviously plays are written to be performed, and that's just sort of the incarnation of them in many ways, so many modern adaptations of Shakespeare's plays are nihilistic and horrible, that I find myself getting very angry when I actually watch many of them, because they completely invert and pervert Shakespeare's meaning. So, you know, but you're absolutely right that this looking at Shakespeare through his own eyes does allow us to see the plays with a new life and vibrancy that does really restore our appetite and want to go back and revisit them and reread them.
Well, I would highly encourage people getting the book, The Quest for Shakespeare, because I think this makes a nice companion. Not that I think you need to have both, but, well, yes, I do think you need to have both. But
well, my idea for it, Chris, was that they actually formed two halves of a Gothic arch, that basically you show Shakespeare's Catholicism through the evidence of his life, and then you show Shakespeare's Catholicism through the evidence in the plays, and that one supports the other, and put the two together, and you have a mutually supporting, the Gothic arch of truth, as it were.
How fun is it to watch EWTN's series that you host, of course, The Quest for Shakespeare?
Yes, and there's a second series to accompany the second book as well, which I'm really excited about. It's being edited now at EWTN. Will go out later this year.
Now, you've talked about how modern film versions of the plays, they've lost a lot, the director's interpretation of the plays, and it comes through. Now, I would imagine when you have the actors work on these pieces for EWTN, it's a bit more fun and you're able to make it a little bit truer to what Shakespeare probably really intended.
Right, and what was wonderful about it, actually, is that most of the actors that did the work on the first, and particularly the second series, which as they will be out later this year, were not Catholics, and they were just there as actors. And throughout the course of 2 weeks that we were there, to see their eyes open, and it was a wonderful scene. I appeared on Father Mitch Packer's live show on EWTN while we were there, and some of these actors were in the live audience. And one of the most heartwarming moments of the whole 2 weeks we were there was that this chap put up his hand, and he wasn't a Catholic, wasn't a practicing Catholic, and said that he considered it a true honor to have been part of this project, and that my work on Shakespeare had opened his eyes to the plays. And this is an example of actually evangelizing through the power of Shakespeare and bringing, non-believers who love Shakespeare to the truth through their love of Shakespeare.
Now that, for Shakespeare, to be able to experience that from the great cloud of witnesses, I would assume, hopefully, God willing, that would be part of the goal. I mean, to not only for his time, but for our time as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I know, and one of the many, many numerous legion of errors by the modern academy where literature is concerned is the belief that the literature somehow is not meant to edify and educate. Shakespeare wrote his plays in order to edify and educate his audience. That doesn't mean that they're preachy. It doesn't mean that he's preaching a sermon. It doesn't mean that he's hitting us in the face with what he wants to say. But what he wants to say is there, embedded in the story, embedded in the words, embedded in his language. And when we actually understand that, we are edified and we are educated and we're closer to the truth through the experience.
Well, Joseph, I guess I'm making a big assumption on many members of the audience now that they understand why we're so enthusiastic about Shakespeare and an appreciation that you have really helped to give us, but also in the entire literary world, that sense of why Shakespeare's Catholicism, which we truly believe he was a Catholic, why that's significant. You kind of want to sum up a 13-week part TV series all in just a couple minutes?
Well, the key thing is, of course, that all works of art are the product of the relationship between the artist, the author, and the gift, the muse, the grace. And consequently, the more that we know about the author, the more we'll understand the work. And that's the understanding behind Through Shakespeare's Eyes, seeing the Catholic presence in the plays. The first book and the first series in EWTN, which has been broadcast over the past year, looks at the evidence from his life, the documentary evidence. But the next series and the new book look at the evidence from three of his finest plays.
What I love about this is that you've made me look at The Merchant of Venice in a totally different way. I mean, I have to admit, I was, even after The Quest for Shakespeare, I could not go there because I still had... Can I term it a prejudice towards The Merchant of Venice because of Shylock? But you've caused me to go back and totally rediscover this play.
Well, that's wonderful. It's obviously part of my hope for when I was writing about Merchant of Venice, because it's one of the least understood and most misunderstood of Shakespeare's plays. I wanted to try to clarify that. It was the same for me. I mean, your experience of it was the same for me. I was uncomfortable with the alleged anti-Semitism of the play, obviously the character of Shylock. And this was accentuated for me by a performance of the play back in England when I lived in England, where none of the words of the play were changed, but the Christian characters, such as Antonio and Bassanio, were skinheads. Mm-hmm. And in between their lines, they would spit at Shylock and kick him. So no words were changed, but the entire meaning was such that Shylock becomes this persecuted hero, whereas in actual fact, in the play, he is very much a villain. But he's a villain not because he's Jewish, but because he's a usurer, because he's a spiteful villain that wants to actually kill out of vengeance and will not be open to any reason that's put before him. And the fact that his daughter Jessica is accepted with open arms as a Christian the moment she converts shows that there's no suggestion of racism. Right. You know, you imagine a member of the Ku Klux Klan accepting a black person because they wanted to join.
Mm-hmm.
You know, clearly, you know, that's what racism is. But Shakespeare's understanding of Judaism and Christianity is purely a theological thing, and of course the differences are there to be discussed. But it's not about Judaism and Christianity, it's about usury and villainy versus virtue and Christian understanding of commerce.
Mm-hmm. And it's very important for us to keep in perspective, again, when this is during the reign of, it's hard for me to call her good Queen Bess anymore.
I always call her Bloody Bess.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about how many Catholics she put to death, and many of whom have since been canonized by the church. You know, it's a travesty of history that, it's said, of course, that the history is written by the victors, and mm-hmm. the England Protestant historians have made of Queen Elizabeth a heroine. But in actual fact, she was Bloody Bess.
And she put to death a tremendous Jesuit priest, Robert Southwell, who had an impact, as you have pointed out, in Shakespeare's life. And you know that because his works you can parallel in The Merchant of Venice, that you can see his character come to life even though he's not named.
Exactly. I mean, what in the first book, The Quest for Shakespeare, I look at the evidence to show that Shakespeare almost definitely knew St. Robert Southwell, and that indeed that St. Robert Southwell was could very possibly have been Shakespeare's confessor. We know he was the confessor of the Earl of Southampton, Shakespeare's patron. And I say the evidence is very strong that Shakespeare knew him. The second book I look at, you know, particularly in The Merchant of Venice, certainly parallels between Shakespeare's lines in The Merchant of Venice and some of St. Robert Southwell's poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, much of the plot of The Merchant of Venice, particularly the trial scene with Shylock, where Antonio is sort of put in the position of St. Robert Southwell with the martyr, and also in the choosing of the casket, the language is such that it's almost, we could almost say that the subtext of The Merchant of Venice is a commentary upon the imprisonment, torture, and subsequent martyrdom of this wonderful Jesuit priest.
I've never looked at the character of Portia quite the way I have now since I've read the book, and her virtue and how that was lifted up, given through these new eyes of reading this play.
Yeah, the wonderful thing as well is that Shakespeare's heroine, Shakespeare's female characters, in many of the plays are so strong. In many respects, they eclipse the male. And this is wonderful because, you know, Shakespeare, of course, is not a feminist, but what he certainly is someone that knows the power of womanhood, the power of motherhood, the power of the feminine. And really, in many ways, his female characters eclipse his male. So we have these strong, wonderful characters such as Portia in The Merchant of Venice and Cordelia in King Lear that just really are inspiring in their virtue and their understanding of the faith and in their willing to sacrifice themselves for the truth.
And I think that you can see his respect for that in the way he raised his own daughters, too, and the influence his wife must have had on those daughters, because jumping out of the place for a moment, I mean, his own daughter was very strong in her integrity.
Well, absolutely. I mean, his daughter was fined for her recusancy, for her militant, defiant Catholicism, and indeed her epitaph, which is, you know, obviously she died about 8 years after Shakespeare. After her father, shows that defiance and that love for her father.
Yeah, just amazing. And again, when we talk about their characters, not just The Merchant of Venice, because I want people to get the book. I don't want Joseph to tell us too much about it, because I want you to get this, because it's such an engaging read. I mean, you have such a way of writing, Joseph.
Thank you. I certainly try to ensure that I write in a way which is accessible to the general public. I'm not interested in writing purely for an academic audience.
But, of course, when you take a look at Hamlet, oh, my gosh. Now I get what you were saying about the movies, because once you read it, especially given the paradigm that you've presented here, the recent movies really do fall short.
Yeah. Well, they don't understand it. That's the trouble. That's
yeah.
One of the reasons that books such as this are so necessary, that modern directors of Shakespeare do not understand the deeply Christian morality that's at work there, that even in the tragedies, there's always the light of the happy ending off stage. Hamlet, for instance, is the whole play is about his coming to maturity. He starts in despair, or at least tempted to despair, and even tempted to suicide, and ends up with a serene acceptance of God's providence and his place in God's providence, and his acceptance of that for his own fate. So, you know, this is about a man growing up in virtue, growing up in faith, and really it's a conversion story. A man who goes from desolation and near despair to an embrace and acceptance of Christ.
I think that appreciation of who the ghost represents, again, when I talk about paradigms, it makes the difference in this play.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if what we show and what we see is that Hamlet goes to great trouble to find out whether the ghost is who he says he is. In other words, whether he's truthful or whether he's a liar. And Hamlet discovers that the ghost is indeed truthful. The ghost is who he says he is. And if that's true, then the ghost is a soul in purgatory, a Catholic soul in purgatory. And therefore, it's the ghost who sees the action of the play through the eyes of eternity. In other words, through the eyes of objective truth. And so the light that the ghost sheds on the play allows us to understand it much more clearly.
You know, for those who may be a critic of this particular approach to Shakespeare's plays, they might be saying you're trying to read more into it than there is. But then again, this is the greatest writer of English literature, English theater that has ever been. Why would he not go to these types of depths to convey these kind of truths?
Well, absolutely. I mean, a great writer doesn't use superfluous words. The more that a work of literature has unnecessary words, the less it's good. So the better the writer, the more the words are there because they're meant to be there. Every single one of them, like carefully placed bricks in a building. So consequently, you know, the meaning of Shakespeare's plays are to be found by looking closely at what he says. And I would happily argue in open debate with any of these nihilistic readers of Shakespeare and show them how their position vis-a-vis its meaning is untenable in the light of the actual words on the page.
Well, you also know that there are those critics out there who have even lifted up Christopher Marlowe as the actual author of the Shakespearean plays and have totally discounted Shakespeare, I mean, period.
Yeah, and I fear and I suspect that the more that the evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism comes to light, the more those bizarre theories about someone else writing them will also come to light. But, you know, but again, the plays would be a denial of that in themselves because, you know, someone like Christopher Marlowe, well, first of all, of course, Christopher Marlowe was dead by the time most of these were written.
Mm-hmm.
That clear. You have to have conspiracy theories about him being, you know, whisked off secretly to the continent and writing his plays from there in secret. I mean, you have to believe that sort of conspiracy nonsense to actually even take it seriously. But even were you to do that, you know, the profound Christian morality in Shakespeare's plays would belie the fact that a non-Christian could write it. So we'd have to assume that Christopher Marlowe, after his secret death, actually also became a Catholic for that to actually be true.
Again, I have to revisit the female characters in this because Ophelia in Hamlet. Now, there is a character that, given modern-day interpretation, I mean, she is one that is just, Prozac wouldn't help this poor girl. But then when you understand that paradigm of Shakespeare's Catholicism, the Ophelia character really is transformed, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, and Shakespeare depicts weakness as well. He portrays weakness. The poor Ophelia's downfall, you know, is not active pernicious evil in the sense that we could say that applies, for instance, to her father or to King Claudius. It's merely a passive acceptance of evil through a weak will and an inability to resist it. And, you know, the same up to a point, without going maybe too far down this tangent, because this I'm still writing this, the same can be said of Juliet in Romeo and Juliet. Mm-hmm. These characters are characters we feel a great deal of sympathy for, but they're really largely defined by their weakness.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, King Lear, of course, is another one of the plays that you enter into in this discovery. And what is it about King Lear that seems to continue to touch the hearts of modern-day man?
Well, you know, again, many modern readers seeing Lear a sort of a desperate, despairing, existentialist sort of materialism and atheism.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, you know, if you actually look at the story of King Lear, he begins in foolishness, in wanting to be told lies, basically, to make himself feel better, and ends in profound wisdom, and indeed with a vision, almost a beatific vision, a vision of heaven. The last thing he sees is a vision of the resurrected Cordelia, his daughter resurrected, and he dies, consequently, deliriously happy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have a play that begins in stupidity and ends in conversion.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same as Hamlet. It's a play that begins in darkness and despair and ends in conversion. So these so-called tragedies that actually have, if you see them through the eyes of Shakespeare, through the eyes of a believing Catholic, they actually have happy endings, and therefore, technically speaking, are not tragedies at all.
Yeah, fascinating. I mean, just absolutely fascinating. It does, because, I mean, they can appear dreary, but then that's a very Catholic bent, isn't it? It's always pointing towards that resurrection.
Yeah, I mean, Tolkien, for instance, you know, another wonderful Catholic writer, said that as a Catholic, I see history as the long defeat with only occasional glimpses of final victory. And in the Salve Regina, we talk about this valley of tears and this land of exile, you know, that to actually look at life is to look at a lot of darkness, but there is that final victory. Now, in Shakespeare's plays, that final victory is hinted at. It's that what Tolkien calls the occasional glimpse of final victory is given within the play, but the actual final victory itself is off stage. And that's exactly, of course, the experience we have of life. That this is a struggle, but the final victory is off stage. You know, when we die, that's when, if we deserve it at that stage through the mercy of God, that's when we actually see and experience the final victory that's won for us by Christ.
When we look at the life of Shakespeare, of course, we think of that time of the Elizabethan court, and after her death, that hope that there would be that opportunity to be able to openly express their religious faith. But then, of course, that was crushed. And we can see that in his later plays as well, can't we? That whole movement, that emotional movement.
Absolutely. One of the strongest pieces of evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism is to look at the sort of plays he writes. So, for instance, under Queen Elizabeth, when he talks about royalty, he's preoccupied with the question of legitimacy. Now, you know, Catholics believe that Queen Elizabeth was illegitimate because she was the child of Anne Boleyn, which was a marriage which was illicit because the divorce to his previous wife, Catherine of Aragon, had not been granted by the Pope. So therefore, under Elizabeth, when he's dealing with treating royalty, he's talking about legitimacy. When Elizabeth dies, there's this brief period of a year or so when Catholics really believe that James I would relieve them of the persecution and bring back religious liberty. And so we have in plays such as All's Well That Ends Well and Measure for Measure, which Shakespeare wrote at about the time that James comes to the throne, this almost great sense of elation and relief,
mm-hmm.
And also becoming more overt in the Catholicism because the fear has removed somewhat. And then under James, the same heavy persecution emerges, and after that we have this period of desolation that, oh no, now we have a new king who's going to be on the throne for another 20 or 30 years because he's young. No, because in Shakespeare's time, Queen Elizabeth was old, so the Catholics were just waiting for her to die,
mm-hmm.
in the hope that things would then be better. Well, now you have this new young king, and the persecution continues, and that led to the sort of desolation and desperate measures that led, for instance, to the gunpowder plot. And at the same time, Shakespeare then writes his plays, that are called his darkest plays, and in some ways they are, but there's still this glimpse of final victory. So in these so-called dark plays, Hamlet, Macbeth, King Lear, Othello, all of which were written at this time when they realized the persecution is going to continue, still contain this profound Christian understanding of the glimpse of final victory that exists even in this valley of tears.
Well, okay, just as a side note, just between you and me and several thousand listeners, okay, have you seen Showtime's The Tudors?
I have not.
Don't. It will drive you crazy.
I think I saw a bit of it once, and that was enough.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you talk about the rewriting the history. Beautifully filmed, I would imagine, yeah. Great acting, but my gosh, the twisting of this history. And you know, Joseph, there's going to be generation of adults who will grow up thinking this is how it was in this time in England.
Well, the sad thing, of course, is that many people get their understanding of reality from the television, and that obviously is very, very dangerous, and it just leaves you with not only a twisted but a dumbed-down understanding of reality, which is one of the reasons, of course, that we write books and we promote books and we sell books, especially to try to spread the truth in the midst of this mega lie that's being told through the mass media.
Right.
Well, and I think that's one of the reasons why I love your work so much, because it is important for us to understand why Shakespeare, the reality of his Catholicism, of his profession of faith, and his perseverance even during a time of persecution, really, it speaks a very important message for today, doesn't it?
It does indeed. You know, we live in an age where secular fundamentalism is on the rise and where there is the possibility of persecution of Christians because of their belief. You know, we've heard the stories about Christian pastors being threatened or sent to prison for talking about sin and homosexuality. So we live in an age of secular fundamentalism. So it's not beyond belief that within a few years we might be living in a time of much greater persecution than we're used to. But, you know, we know that throughout the history of the church, these periods of persecution have been recurring. And Shakespeare lived through one of the worst periods, you know, when many, many hundreds of Catholics were put to bloody death, really hideous death, purely for being Catholics. And so to have the witness of this great writer writing in times of such persecution will perhaps become even more relevant as we may be moving into an area of era of persecution ourselves.
Right. Well, I am looking forward to volume upon volume upon volume of your quest for Shakespeare through his plays, through the eyes of Shakespeare, however you want to call it, as long as it has your name as the author.
I've become something. I mean, I'm a Shakespeare addict, and I can't leave him alone. So I want to write some other things this year as well, and please God, I shall. But at the moment, I'm completely and utterly sucked into Romeo and Juliet and enjoying it thoroughly.
You know what? And I just have to tell people, go out and get Old Thunder, because that is still one of my all-time favorite biographies. And Hilaire Belloc, I mean, oh my gosh, I love reading that book. I replay that interview that we did with you a couple of years ago on that, Joseph, just because I love the story.
Well, Chris, let me let you into a secret here between you and me and Bruce and several thousand other listeners, that I sort of judge the sort of Catholics that I think are really the right sort of Catholics for me by whether or not they like Hilaire Belloc.
Mm.
So therefore, once again, Chris, you have proved that you're my sort of Catholic.
Oh, God. I just, you know, we'll just take that path to Rome. How's that?
Why not?
Okay.
Why not? Absolutely. Joseph Pierce joining us today through Shakespeare's eyes, seeing the Catholic presence in his plays. And Joseph, as we wrap up again, our all too brief time together, final thought or observation as we close?
Well, merely that through the power of great art and great culture, we can actually spread the light of the gospel to the world. That's what I'm trying to do, to evangelize the culture through the power of culture.
Oh, all right. Well, I love it. You keep up the power.
Yep.
All more
Thank
power
you.
To you. How's that?
Thank you.
Yeah, well, as modern secularism continues to bump, and especially in the area of Shakespeare, thank God we have Joseph Pierce to bump back.
That's right.
Thank you so much.